The Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. We do not quite have a quorum yet, but we are going to hear House File 1262, and we'll delay action on that until we have a quorum. Representative Mahoney, welcome to the committee.
Do I really want to do this?
Okay, we will hear the bill, and then I'll move it. I'll move the bill for you, Representative Mahoney, once we have a quorum. But let's Representative Mahoney has the DE2 amendment. Would you like to offer that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to offer that amendment.
Okay, Representative Mahoney. Why don't we just have you explain the amendment, and then we'll adopt the amendment once we have a quorum also and get the bill in the shape that you want it.
Mr. Chair, we can do that. These are the kind of bills you like, because everyone is in reasonable agreement at this particular time to move forward this way. The DE amendment, DE2 amendment, is an agreement to send the joint physical custody issue to a study group convened by the state court administrator, a group of 12 members, and I'm going to read this because I'll forget somebody if I don't. The court administrator must ensure that the viewpoint of parent advocacy groups, citizen members who are not associated with the parent advocacy group, academics and policy analysis, analysts, judges, court administrators, attorneys, domestic violence advocates, and other interested parties are represented. The state court administrator shall consult with the chairs of the House Public Finance, Public Safety Finance Committee, and the Senate Public Safety Budget Division on the composition of the working group. They shall report to the legislature on the evaluation of presumption of joint physical custody, the experiences of other states, and recommendations made by the study group no later than January 15, 2009. Mr. Chair, that is the amendment. I think there's two possibilities here. We can look for a solution that that will work, or we can swing the pendulum of anger to the other side, and that won't work. We need to find a solution that takes the anger and rancor away from this particular issue and works for the betterment of the parents and the children. And with that, I'd ask for your support on this particular amendment.
Okay. At this point, the chair will move House File 1262, be recommended to pass, and return to the Finance Committee with a recommendation for a re-referral to the General Register. And then I would, the chair will move the DE2 amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Oops. Last question. the amendment prevails. And now to the bill. Does everyone fully understand what we're doing here? Well, I'd just like to say, Mr. Mahoney, I really appreciate your willingness to compromise on this. I know this has been a long-standing issue for you and others in the legislature, and I hope that this is a satisfactory resolution, that we can bring all sides together and have a frank discussion and dialogue about what's in the best interest of children and parents and what makes the most sense, and that I have committed to you that the language that you included on the bill that gives us some decision making about the composition of the committee, that it will be a fair and balanced composition, and that we expect a good and thorough evaluation of joint physical custody and recommendations by the study group by January 2009. Should also note that the amendment also has a second part to it that also deals with a comprehensive study of family law. So there's two parts. We didn't think we could do part one and two at the test, but we might have to change that. I don't know if we can do both of those on January 15, 2009.
Mr. Chair, I think you're correct. I would be more than willing to accept an oral amendment to the date that you think would be appropriate, whether it's 2009 or 2010.
Why don't we just pass
and
it
I can
out.
Do that on the
we
floor
can have
if you'd
discussions.
Like.
I thought we were doing that in two stages, and maybe I was in error, but we can have
yeah.
find it out. Mr. Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, either you or the author of the bill, there probably won't be a shortage of people willing to serve on this study group, and I can understand that. But I do notice that there is no funding mechanism for this study group. Is it the chair's intent or the office's intent that the people who both serve and staff this study group would do so on a voluntary basis?
Representative Biskins, it's my understanding, yes, that they will do so on a voluntary basis and that the course will absorb the cost of this, and part of this is something that they were intending on doing, but we can have someone from the course, Janet Marshall or Stu DeSalle is here. Of course, I could be totally wrong, too. So
but you are the chair of the Finance Division.
Mr. Saw?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have had some discussions about the general scope of this, and we feel that we can undertake the study, and we'll have to figure out how that happens, whether we try to get volunteer staff, essentially, or reporters for this, or whether we're able to do it ourselves. So we will undertake that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions on the bill? Let's change it now. The chair will move on line 1.16, strike the word committee and insert the division. Representative Mahoney, that was an oversight. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Oh.
Where is that?
Line 1.16. It should say that.
Strike the word committee and
insert the word division.
Oh.
Any other questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, now we have the bill. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Thank you, Representative Mahoney. All those in favor of House file. I'm sorry. Let me just, before we do that, let's just see if there's anybody in the audience who wishes to speak on either in for or opposition to the bill. Down here. Okay, now, all those in favor of, I will remove my motion. All those in favor of House File 1262 being recommended to pass, return to the Finance Committee. As amended, with a recommendation for re-referral to the General Register. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, committee members.
Okay, now we will hear the a very brief order post-board presentation. Mr. Melton, do you want to? We have a very small budget item that you said you could do in a couple of minutes, or
Mr.
less.
Mr. Chair, I can do this in less than 15 seconds. For the record, my name is Neil Melton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training. Governor's supplemental budget included $50,000 to post. That was to correct an error from the 07 session spreadsheet that we found. Therefore, the $50,000 has no direct impact to post other than to correct that error.
Mr. Melton, I just have one question about the $50,000. What's it going for?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that sticks to the operating budget to maintain staff.
Okay, and I'm just curious about the staff. What does that staff person actually do?
That staff person currently, without mentioning names, although she's here, is our legislative rules coordinator and deals with the standards committee.
Okay. And how much time does that person expend lobbying in the legislature?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wouldn't say that she lobbies. She just maintains contact and tracks all of the bills, because law enforcement has bills that pop in some really obscure committees from agriculture to so forth. I don't imagine it's much more than 10 to 15% of her time.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Melton. And now we will, as we started yesterday, we are reviewing the governor's recommendations for possible cuts to all of the divisions that are under the auspices of this committee. And we've allotted the rest of our committee time to the court. And we have several people who want to testify, and I'll just turn it over to Mr. Salas at this point.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sue Dosal. I'm the State Court Administrator. Our plan for this presentation is to start out with having Jeff Shorba, the Deputy State Court Administrator, and Judge Ed Lynch, who is the Assistant Chief Judge in the First District, Chamberlain, Dakota County, kind of set the table for the discussion of the impact of the governor's cut by talking about where we are right now with some of our budget challenges for dealing with this 08, 09 budget as it is before the cut. And then after that, I'm going to talk a little bit high level on the impact of the budget cut, and we've asked, by way of examples, to have the Chief Judge of the 4th District and the Chief Judge of the 10th District, as well as one of your former colleagues who's now a judge, come and talk a little bit about what this is going to mean on the ground for them. So now I'm going to turn this over to Jeff Shorba.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Shorba. As you said, I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator, and I'm going to begin the presentation by talking a little bit about our compensation for this current biennium. Unlike other parts of state government, the courts do not have large programs that can be cut back in tough times. About 85% of our budget is spent on judges and court employees involved in the adjudication process across the state. Last year, we requested about $38.9 million for judges and staff compensation. This request was based on what we believe is a conservative estimate of a 2.5% cost of living adjustment plus steps and insurance for our employees. And we really appreciated the legislator's support for that request at the time it was funded. As you can see from the budget overview, though, a branch received a little less money for our compensation increases, 12.9% less than requested, based on a formula that was used across the state agencies of a 3% increase for compensation. In addition, much of the new money that you provided last session was ridered, which limited our ability and flexibility to use that funding for our compensation needs. After the close of the session, and following a pattern of union negotiations by the executive branch, judicial branch COLAs mirrored the executive branch COLAs and were set at 3.25%, plus absorbing the increased costs for steps and insurance. This lack of funding created a greater than anticipated hole in our personnel budget, and has required the branch to take some significant steps during this current biennium in order to maintain a balanced budget and to meet this $12.9 million deficit. I'm going to turn now to Ed Lynch, who's going to talk a little bit about the steps that have been taken internally to try to maintain that balanced budget.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ed Lynch. I'm a judge in the First Judicial District, and I am in Chamberlain, Dakota County. When it became apparent that the judicial branch would be unable to fund the current compensation obligation, the Judicial Council instructed the district administrators and state court administration to take and identify aggressive cost-cutting measures. These measures are shown on the slide right now. Administrators determined that 207 positions, or 7% of our staff, will need to be held open or abolished to save enough funds to meet our current compensation obligations. And those districts that are not able to accomplish this through attrition, layoffs will be necessary. Some of the districts have offered voluntary early separation programs to their employees. At this time, it's anticipated that 42 employees will take advantage of this offer and help relieve the budget pressure. Employees throughout the state are being asked to take unpaid days off. In the third judicial district, Employees wanting to be part of the solution have agreed to take time off without pay to save positions. In Rochester alone, enough time has been volunteered to save the equivalent of one position. Courthouses in at least three judicial districts, the 3rd, the 4th, and the 10th, are closing public counters at least one afternoon a week to enable staff to catch up on processing of paperwork and other important work that cannot be done because of the reduction in staff positions. All levels of court are scrutinizing operational budgets to identify cost containment measures. But as you know, our budget is 85% personnel, so any savings that you can get from buying cheaper printer paper is not going to make much of an impact and probably will not lessen the need to cut staff. Fewer conciliation court calendars are being scheduled in some counties, and other service cutbacks are being discussed. All 10 judicial districts have submitted letters to the chair outlining details on what they are doing to contain costs. So I'm not going to go over in any detail because they're in your packet, but I just want to mention that the cuts are affecting every district in the state. I know you understand that these cost-cutting measures do not reduce the overall workload of the court. Cases will continue to be filed at the rate of over 2 million each year, and so the remaining staff will have to do more with less. We can't close the courts one day each week and reduce our workload by 400,000 cases per year. The work does not go away, it merely piles up. I don't consider myself an alarmist, and I'm certainly not here to say that the judicial branch sky is falling. But I do fear that because of the budget pressures, there are cracks beginning in the foundation. I have never seen before the level of concern, stress, frustration, or exhaustion at all court facilities throughout the state than is present now because of these budget concerns. It is no longer a question of the quality of service we can provide. It is a question of whether we can meet our constitutional duty to provide meaningful access to justice for the people of this state. In the past, in order to respond to increased work and limited resources, the courts have relied upon improved technology, better management, implementing best practices, and the willingness of judges, administrators, and staff to take on more and more responsibilities. Those options have been spent, and frankly, I don't think there are any more rabbits in the hat that can help absorb additional costs and cuts. I want to emphasize that this is not about judges, and despite the impact that your decisions will have on our court staff, it's really not about our court staff. It's about the 2 million cases and the hundreds of thousands of people that each year bring to the court some of the most important matters in their lives. It's about abused spouses seeking protection, neglected children seeking safety, conflicting businesses seeking resolution, divorcing couples seeking finality, and injured people seeking stability. And so the question becomes, who do we send away? Who do we ignore? Who do we delay? Those are the choices that we will have to make if additional positions are held open or layoffs are necessary. Let me put some context to this. Who among these real-life examples should receive priority when there are insufficient staff to process their cases in a timely manner? Should it be the sex offender who is just going to be released from prison and who faces a civil commitment as a sexually dangerous person? Should it be the wife who came to court for an order for protection after discovering her husband's journal that described his plans and preparations to kill her and the children? Should it be the elderly man who lost a leg in an accident and cannot obtain medical services because the two companies that insure him cannot agree who is primarily responsible for payment? Or should it be the preteen girl who was regularly beaten by her mother with an extension cord and wrote a letter to the court that ended with a plea in big block letters, "Please help me"? I know that you have difficult decisions to make this session, and I know that you recognize that meaningful access to justice is as important to the people of this state as smaller class sizes and shorter commute times. When you establish your priorities this session, I urge you to keep in mind the real-life people who need the services of the court and whose lives and constitutional rights may be affected by your decision. And if you have any questions for me, I will take them now because I have to leave to do a calendar in Hastings.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excellent. Thank you. Has this started already, or is this a proposal?
It has started. In our district, for instance, the first district, there are 12 and a half positions that are presently held open in order to address the budget concerns.
Ms. Snyder Murphy.
I just needed that clarification, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Judge Lynch? Thank you for your testimony.
And I want to mention briefly issues in our mandated services area. Along with the compensation pressures that I mentioned earlier, last fall the courts also began to see costs in our mandated services area begin to far outpace the increases we predicted when we were before you last year in three important areas: interpreters, psychological services, and jury costs. Despite efforts to stem this growth, it continues, and with the compensation pressures and no ability to absorb them, legally mandated services costs have been included in a supplemental budget request, which is on the left side of your packet, in the amount of $1.9 million. I just want to spend a minute to go over those requests briefly. The use of interpreters in our courtrooms is directly related, as you know, to the continued influx of immigrants into Minnesota. As you can see from this graph, the number of people granted permanent legal residence from 2005 to 2006 grew at a rate of 18%. This is not just a metro phenomenon. We are seeing immigration increase across the state. Statistics for interpreted events, the number of times we use interpreters in our courthouses, also grew at a similar rate of 21% from 2005 to 2006. In 2007, we provided interpreters in 81 languages and on average used them 152 times per day in our courts. This is not a metro phenomenon, as I mentioned. Unfortunately, most of the interpreters live in the metro area, but we have seen significant growth in the outstate area of Minnesota. For example, in Roseau, they have a growing Laotian population. The nearest interpreter for that language lives in Elk River. In the past year, he's had to interpret 12 times in Roseau County, including overnight expenses. Hearing costs average around $700. So just for that one interpreter going to that one location, an annual cost of $8,400. And these costs continue to increase all over the state in the interpreter area. The second growth area is psychological services. By statute, the courts must pay the cost for Rule 20 psychological examinations in criminal cases to determine if a person is competent to stand trial and for court-ordered examinations to determine if a person is to be civilly committed. Highly skilled licensed psychologists and psychiatrists provide these services. Almost all cases require two examinations. The court orders the first, and the defendant has a statutory right to a second examination. Since many of these proceedings, as you know, result in civil commitments for extended periods of time, it is very rare that a case proceeds without two examinations. This chart shows how the costs for psychological examinations continue to grow. From fiscal year 06 to fiscal year 07 alone, the costs grew 12%. The significant cost increase is due to two factors, primarily. Sexually dangerous persons and sexual psychopathic personality case filings increased 37% from fiscal year 06 to fiscal year 07, and the increased complexity of the exam. Examiners are being asked to review more and more material, driving up the overall cost of the exam. Some of this cost is also due to local practices and priorities. For example, during fiscal year 07 in Olmsted County, there were 10 sexual predator cases filed during the entire year. For the first half of fiscal year 08, there have already been 16 cases filed, with the average cost of examiners in these cases at $12,420 per case with two exams. Already the budget for this county alone is about $124,000 over last year. The Attorney General's office and the county attorneys decide when to file these cases. It is based on their own priorities. The court has no choice but to pay the examiner costs, and as the filings increase and their priorities increase, we are left with these increased costs. The last area is jury. This increase in jury costs is driven primarily by the increases in felony and gross misdemeanor trials, 9.6% and 6.8% respectively. After a period of relative stability in fiscal year 05 and 06, the number of trials has begun to increase dramatically and is expected to remain at this higher level. Increased jury trial activities result in increased costs. More citizens are called for jury service, expected to increase 10% from 07 to 08, and more citizens serve on juries. The number of individuals sworn in as jurors was up 6.4% in 07 and is expected to grow an additional 4% in FY08. This $1.9 million are unavoidable costs and mandated services that the courts must pay, and therefore we felt it was necessary at the time to increase, to put in this increase for $1.9 million. I can answer any questions about mandated services that you'd like.
Mr. Sherba, I we met in my office the other day, and I feel like my memory must be like totally clouded, but you came here last year with a budget for mandated services, and we gave you everything you asked for, to the penny. So how is it possible that you can come, less than a year later and say our projections were way off? And how do you not know that? How do you not, it seems to me like smart minds would get together and figure out what you would need so we're not so off kilter here and now looking at this huge deficit in mandated services. How does that happen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we tried our best to make predictions based on the numbers that we knew at the time, and as you're aware, we make these predictions over a year and a half ago in October before the budget session comes forward. We began to look again after the session, and our first quarter numbers were even higher than this, and we did some initiatives within the judiciary, the judicial council met, we had subcommittees looking at these mandated services areas, and we were able to stem the growth to the number you see now of $1.9 million. But as I mentioned in the presentation, these costs are not ones that we control. We can make our best estimates on how many cases are going to come forward in psychological services or how many interpreted events are going to need to be in our courtroom, but these numbers continue to go up and up. As you saw in the interpreter area, the most recent statistics we have are for 2005 to 2006. There's a delay in Homeland Security and our own departments here in the state providing us with these statistics. So we go with the number of statistics and the information we have as soon as possible. We now have new numbers as they come out showing that this cost continued to rise even higher than we had predicted. So all I can tell you is we went with the best numbers that we had, and we felt it was necessary to tell you that these costs are continuing to increase. And again, as I mentioned, they're not costs that we can control or actually can tell you how many are going to come in. It's based on other people's priorities. So unfortunately, it's the best prediction that we have at this particular time, and we felt it was necessary to bring the information to the committee because of the cost pressures that we're feeling. And the added information is, in other years, maybe we're able to absorb these kind of costs as they change and fluctuate through the biennium. But in this biennium, due to the compensation pressures, we're not able to absorb that as well as we might have been. And also, some of the other costs that we got that we're having to go to other things that were rendered in the bill. So, unfortunately, that's the situation that we're in right now.
And then a final question. If I remember correctly, you didn't want us to actually tell you to spend a certain amount for mandated services, but you just wanted am I incorrect about what one of your agenda items was last year, that you just wanted us to give you a bulk sum of money?
Maybe Ms. Rostowski.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, the tradition has been to give the judicial branch flexibility in how it spends its money. There are always some riders that are in there, but last year they were all ridered, essentially, and that decreased the flexibility that we might have otherwise had.
And had we just given you that lump sum of money, would that have altered anything?
Well, it would have given us a little more flexibility, I think. As we're saying right now, we are managing. We're struggling with essentially the $13 million shortfall, and we would not be here talking about anything else, but it's really, as we're going to talk in a few minutes, the proposed cut that I think was really the straw that could break the camel's back here.
It's no leaving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Sherba, of course, thank you for coming to see me yesterday, and Mr. Orsell, and we had a little conversation too about some of these issues, and certainly I can appreciate the difficulty that the courts are having with these things, but we talked a little bit about the interpreter's issue and the fact that there's a rule that interpreters get a minimum of 2 hours And we talked a little bit about that, and I'd like you just to address that for the committee so that we're all fully aware of that issue. And I'm not sure if we should, you know, what, if anything, can or should be done about it, but I just think that the entire committee should hear about that. And then returning to the issue also of the increases in jury trials, I know that the numbers of felonies and gross misdemeanors are going up, but I wonder if that is the increase in jury trials simply proportional to the number of cases, or is there also a shift going on in the number of those cases that are going to jury trial? I wonder if you could address any of that.
Mr. Sherba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rubling, on the interpreter issue, there's an industry standard that is used not only in the courts, but in other places like hospitals and other employers that use interpreters, which, as Representative Liebling was mentioned, is a two-hour standard, which means that you are paid for 2 hours whether you are used for 2 hours or not. So you travel to a location, you get there and say a case settles, or a defendant doesn't show up, or a witness doesn't show up, that interpreter, usually what we try first is to find some other event for that interpreter to be used for in the courtroom or in the courthouse that day. If that's not possible, there is a two-hour minimum standard that the interpreter is paid. And as I mentioned, that's something that's industry-wide to compensate for situations where somebody might not show up. As we mentioned yesterday with Representative Liebling, the courts are a little different from hospitals. When you have a patient in the hospital, you're pretty sure that patient is going to be there when you go to do an interpreted event. When you have a courtroom, sometimes you cannot guarantee that somebody's going to show up or that everything will go as planned. So that's the two-hour minimum that we have. As far as the jury costs go, I think both are factors in the increase in the jury costs. One is the number of cases are going up, but we're also seeing as the penalties and other things go up for these kinds of crimes, there's less likelihood not only on the defendant's part to plead, but rather to ask for a jury trial, but also in some cases prosecutors who are very aggressive with some of these cases. And from the anecdotes that we're hearing from our court staff, there's less likelihood in some jurisdictions for individuals not only to plead, but for prosecutors to agree to a deal. So I think that both are factors in the increase in the jury costs that we're seeing.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. At our next hearing, I'd like the staff, to fiscal and otherwise, to provide us the following information with regard to psychological services. I heard testimony today that there's a statutory right to a second examination, and that the cost of $12,420 per case was to exam. So I guess I'd like the information from staff as to two items. Number one, when the statutory right to a second examination originated, and secondly, what that cost is broken down for the second examination, so that we have the numbers in front of us if we should choose by statute to eliminate that second exam. So I'd like that fiscal information.
Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have some other questions after this, and we get to the governor's recommended cut. But I do have questions about at the front end when this happens. I know in Ramsey County, between 70% and 80% of cases that come through arraignment are assigned a public defender. So the government pays both sides to fight it out, sometimes lengthening it in certain cases which may or may not have merit. And I know that when you ask the public defenders, geez, why are you representing all these people that make more money than both you or I do, because Project Remand comes through with what they say on the sheet they make, which they say they make a very low amount of money, and they say, yep, the bench qualifies them. And many people concede that, well, let's just try to get this done quickly. Nonetheless, we end up with the entirety of the system of paying both sides to battle it out, 70% to 80%. And I'm wondering, are there any plans by the state court administrator to re-examine how public defender cases, how people are qualified for public defenders, and how that may impact the overall lengthening of any court process?
Mr. Song.
Chair and Representative Lesch, I know that a number of years ago we looked at this issue of public defender screening and have put in place in some locations what we call screener collectors. There is, and we've taken a look at that, but I think that we have no plans right now, and we would have no ability right now to add on some additional investigation of an individual's background, and we haven't been able to do that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and then just by way of comment, I think this is a serious problem that I see in Ramsey County that consistently comes back. It comes down to a philosophical difference between who should get an attorney and who shouldn't. There are plenty of people who think that we should just pay for everyone to get an attorney, and if that's the case, then let's just be honest about it. But until then, I think I see public defenders who I work with who are representing clients that make a lot more money than they do, and we know how we're paying our public defenders these days, which isn't very great. I think there's a justice issue with that, but it also very much impacts the caseload going forward and how many people do then decide they're not going to plead, they're going to fight it out, and then get access to psychological services and the other special court services, jury trials that come in place. So I'm going to be looking at this in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Lesh, if we're giving public defenders, if public defenders are getting clients that they shouldn't have because they don't qualify, that's one thing. I think there's perhaps an impact on the public defender budget there, but I hope you're not saying, the system should be cheaper by not giving people counsel. I mean, I really hope we're not going there. I mean, sure, we could do everything a whole lot faster if we just brought people in and said, plead guilty and on to jail with you. And I don't think we want to go there. So, I mean, I hope that's not the suggestion that you're making, Representative Lesh.
Representative Lesh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Liebling, what I am suggesting is that, no, we shouldn't be giving people attorneys for free who aren't entitled to them. It takes away from the services of people who are rightly entitled to that counsel when they are truly indigent. And for people who get those attorneys for free, who may have an attorney for which they pay, it gives incentive for them to more accurately gauge how they're going to proceed forward, whether it's with a guilty plea or whether they have legitimate constitutional issues that they want to challenge with an attorney who they pay for, and rightfully so. So no, I'm not suggesting that, but I think, Mr. Chair and members, this represents that basic philosophical difference. And if others believe we should just pay for everyone and both sides get an attorney every time, we should examine that.
Okay, a little far afield here, Representative Olana.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is also going to be related to public defenders, and let me start by saying at one time there was a shortage. And as to Mr. Lesh's, Representative Lesh's comments, yes, it does happen sometimes, and no, the courts haven't done an adequate job in being able to weed those out, nor do they when they find out that they should have paid, charge them an adequate amount. Because they charge back to the public defender fund $250 on somebody that's probably making close to what I was making. Well, that's not really reality. But the bigger issue I'm going to bring up is at one time in northern Minnesota, we had a public defender, two public defenders in the whole northwest corner of the state. Now, we have more public defenders wandering around Pennington County than Pennington County could possibly ever hire as number of defense as prosecutors, even though the prosecutor has a whole lot of other responsibilities. There has been a lot more, there has been an increase from what I'm hearing up in that area in trials, and some of it's caused, some of it ends up with two public defenders sitting in the one trial trying a case while we have a county attorney that's the sole county attorney without even an assistant in some counties sitting there by himself. And obviously, if there's enough public defenders to do that, there is more pressure on either A, the prosecutor's got to give a case away, or B, there are going to be trials. Now, that's what's happening in some of our area.
Okay, let's, who's next? Any more testifiers?
Mr. Chair, if we can proceed now, we talk about that, the impact on the cut to the judicial branch and to the courts. On Friday, the governor recommended a $9.1 million reduction to the judicial branch budget, which of course is on top of these budget challenges that were just, you know, talked about in terms of the FY 08-09 shortfall. In our view, if this isn't enacted, this cut is going to have very real and publicly apparent consequences, and it will, in our view, compromise our ability to deliver justice in Minnesota. As you just heard, we talked about already, we are short about a little over 200 positions, which represents 7% of our staff system-wide. We're already feeling reductions in public services to the public, and delays are already being felt. We have no ability to absorb this additional mandated services cost that we have been just describing. So in terms of the cut, we have no place else to take it but more people, and the governor's budget of $9 million translates into a loss of approximately another 222 positions. So taking that with what the shortage is right now, we're at about 15% of our staff would be lost in this biennium. So just to give you some idea of the magnitude of this cut, what I have in this chart is the number of court staff, they're actually FTEs, that are allocated to processing different case types. For the trial courts, the governor's cut translates into 193 positions, and that would be sort of the equivalent of wiping out all of the folks that are allocated to handling major civil cases or minor civil cases or parking and probate or most of family. So just to give you an idea that this cut is going to be huge. Some of the steps that we are going to have to consider include, of course, cutting hours of service at courthouses. You've heard that we've already done that in three districts, and clearly that's going to expand to more and statewide. Because if this cut is taken, this is not just an FY09 problem, but an FY10 and 11 problem, we're going to have to look at how many court locations can actually be afforded in Minnesota. On the table right now is the consideration of essentially closing low-volume court locations around the state in greater Minnesota, and also looking at the same thing in terms of suburban facilities and satellite facilities in the urban area. And just to give you an idea, in your packet there is a map, and just for conceptually, we're looking at what's in green are the 12 counties that have no resident judge. There's staff there. Judges travel into those areas from adjoining counties, but there's no resident judge. Those were the kinds of areas that we would be looking at. In total, the budget for these 12 areas is only $2.2 million. So assuming that you could close them down, wipe out all of the staff, and somehow absorb all that workload, the most that you would get is $2.2 million against a $9.1 million problem. In the urban areas, we have some suburban courts, and Judge Whelan and Judge Scherer are probably talking about that in their areas, but just to give you some idea, we think that to close those down and realistically deal with the workload, we're probably talking only of savings about $300,000, you know, for each of those suburban facilities. So a far way away from the $9 million problem that we're talking about. Surely on the table is shutting down drug courts. You were very supportive of that last year. We have 21 operational drug courts around the state. They are showing significant promise for avoiding expensive prison and jail time costs and for avoiding or reducing recidivism. We're seeing people going through these drug courts that are becoming law-abiding and tax-paying individuals, which is good for society, but surely these will be the kinds of programs that would have to be on the table for us. Cutting services to pro se litigants, just to give you some idea of the magnitude of the numbers here. Hennepin County had 33,000 walk-in customers to its self-help center last year, an additional 10,000 email and phone contacts. So if we are talking about cutting services to this in this area, we're talking about impacts on thousands of people around the state. Of course, greatly reducing civil legal services, and you're going to hear from those folks later, but this is going to mean fewer people with low-income people with lawyers, which means more pro se people for us, exacerbating that problem. And, of course, without adequate numbers of staff and without adequate funding for interpreters, psychiatric examinations, guardians ad litem, and jurors, there is going to be a significant delay in case processing and a quickly building backlog in our courts. This chart...
Let me just get a couple of questions in here now, and then we'll let you continue with your presentation. Member Tim Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shaw, on slide 10, where you're talking about the 207 layoffs or not hires or whatever, how many are currently working and how many weren't hired?
Mr. Shaw.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Remember, if you want to repeat, try that again.
You said that on the slide, it says that there's current abolished or open positions for 207 individuals. And how many of those were never hired?
Mr. Thaw.
Well, there many of these are where positions have become vacant and they've just been held open. And then there are others that have taken this voluntary, we're hoping are taking the voluntary separation plan, and then those positions are being, for the most part, abolished. And so that's where this is. Some of them are through natural turnover attrition, and we're having a hiring freeze, so these are all open. And then we, in addition, we have layoff plans in the 3rd and the 10th district because we can't get enough turnover to just keep those positions open naturally.
So except for Mr. Chair, Mr. Sellers, except for the 3rd and 10th districts, then they're all open positions.
That's correct.
And
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sellers, you could tell us or provide us with the numbers in the 3rd and 10th of how many layoffs there will be.
Mr. Sellers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, we certainly are doing that. I think that that information is probably in the packet in the letters that have been provided to the chairman about the impact in each of our districts. I believe they're in there, but I will check to make sure.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'll wait until Mr. Fowler is done with her presentation in case she's going to cover it later.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have to make a comment on 9th Judicial District, obviously, because when you start talking about closing courthouses, the 9th Judicial District took a leadership a few years ago and cut some court administrators, and my county boards went absolutely nuts in fear that they're going to lose their whole counties. Now I'm hearing proposals to do away with the 4 counties up in my northwest corner, not all of which I represent, but still my area, entirely. Because you took those court administrators away a few years ago. Do you realize, do you want to revolt in northwest Minnesota? Because every county attorney, every taxpayer, every county board is going to be up in arms so quick if you start closing courts. Because that's the first step to trying to close a county. And they aren't going to be happy.
Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair and Representative Olin, we certainly understand that. We're just explaining what the realities are. We have, our hands are pretty much tied. We are not going to have the staff under this cut. something has got to give, something significant, not a little bit, but something significant. And these are just some of the things that we're going to have to look at.
No,
just a quick comment. No, I wasn't attacking you for considering that, because I realize that's probably something you do have to consider. I'm just setting out a warning as to what happened when this was done. And it hasn't settled down, because a lot of those other counties are still concerned. It's going to happen to us tomorrow morning.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Olin, I just would mention that I've lived through the time where we have sunsetted and transferred judgeships, not closed courthouses, but sunsetted and transferred judgeships into from greater Minnesota into the metro area. And I know exactly what you mean about the feelings in the local community.
You want to finish the presentation?
So, Mr. Chair, this is a chart just about what we think is likely to happen. We handle these 2 million cases that come in every year. With these kinds of cuts and reduced hours, we're projecting very significant backlogs, as much as 250,000 increase in our pending cases by the end of FY10. So at some point, with these delays, we run into this constitutional guarantee that both civil and criminal cases must be dealt with promptly and without delay. And added to all of this mix, of course, is the reality that typically in bad economic times, our business doesn't go down, it goes up. We have more crime, more domestic violence, more problems with the civil areas, credit problems and the like. So as Judge Lynch indicated, these delays are going to impact very real people that are our mutual constituents. In addition to delays in scheduling and disposing of cases, we're already seeing administrative processing delays that are going to get much worse under this cut. And we see delays in entering criminal case data on our computers, which means we're going to have inaccurate criminal history records that are being relied on every day by thousands of people out there in terms of arrest and release and sentencing decisions. We're going to see delays in processing warrants and arrest detain orders, which of course creates some public safety concerns. Delays in updating satisfying warrants, which means that people can potentially be arrested and incarcerated unlawfully. We see delays in processing redemptions in mortgage cases. Same thing with the enforcement of money judgments. And in your packet is an article about the huge increase that we've realized in default judgments on loan payments and credit cards, 67% statewide. So that obviously is going to be a problem. And of course, we're going to see significant increases in the wait in line time for the public who are coming in to use the services. An example of this is in Ramsey County right now. Citizens are waiting about 2.5 hours to meet with hearing officers to take care of their tickets and other minor matters. And finally, we think without a doubt that we will be seeing collateral consequences for the justice partners and the public. If we can't timely deal with these cases when they start to back up, we're going to see defendants being held longer in jails and those costs going up. Out-of-custody defendants are going to be staying out of custody longer with potential public safety risks. As we talked about in the civil commitment area, if there are backups there, those folks are backing up in very expensive hospital beds, sometimes as much as $700 a day, and this includes the sexual predators. Delays in CHIPS cases have potential impact for counties and increasing their out-of-home placement costs. And the other area that I think we can expect is to see an interruption of the flow of about $200 million in revenue that the courts now collect as we are diverting our staff from lower priority traffic and parking offenses and collection efforts. This will have an impact on that $200 million, which now none of which goes to the courts, all of which goes to the cities, counties, and to the state revenue. So this would be a significant consequence, I think, as well. We'd like to ask the next panel to come up.
One more, one second there. Let's have a couple more questions, and then we'll have the rest. If you're lucky. Well, there's more testifiers. Do you want to wait?
Well,
do you want to...
Why don't I just ask my questions now, Mr. Chair, if I can. Thank you. Mr. Saul, I'm looking at slide number 10, and it has staff loss, current abolished open positions, in the aggregate for trial courts versus appellate courts, and then additional projected layoffs from cuts, trial courts and appellate courts. The first one being 7% altogether for trial and appellate, and the additional being 8%, the total being 15%. Then I look at slide 11 and see impact of cuts related to case type on trial court FTEs, percent of staff. And it says all the way at the bottom, not case related, there's 13%. My question is, you have the staff loss, current staff loss, which I'm noting in Ramsey County is about 15 positions, and there are more projected for 08. And that's about 10% of our positions, I think. How much of a hit are you guys taking up there in court administration vis-a-vis the trial and appellate courts that are being cut?
Well, many of these positions that we are holding open and many of the positions that we have abolished in the past are in the administration area. For example, now, we used to have one court administrator in every county. Now nearly 40% of our counties are operating with a combined court administrator. We combined the 7th and 8th judicial district administrators and all of their staff, so we have reduced in that area as well. Much of the cuts in the positions that we're holding open are in the administrative area. But you have to have some amount of infrastructure in order to deal with that. So we certainly plan to be taking as much as we can across the board between both administrative folks as well as the line staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Sullivan. I understand that. You got to have some kind of skeletal structure to this thing. But when you say court administration, you're combining court administrators, that's what my constituents see on the ground when they go in, that there's an impact to, you know, for example, if there are severe problems in Ramsey County or, you know, in Representative Owens County, there's still a person on the ground up there who happens to be court administration, and that's being cut. But I don't know how many staff you guys have down here across the street, and if you put that in the same category or what. But I'd kind of like to know who's being cut on the ground in the counties, and it may be judges or maybe court administrators or whatever, versus who's being cut down here across the street.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative West, there are three legally separate appropriations for within the judicial branch: the trial courts, the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court operations. And we are taking the same kind of cuts to deal with our problem. And I think if you look at the governor's recommendation, there's a much bigger cut to the Supreme Court that is being proposed than to the other two. So we're having to do the same thing to live within our means.
Representative Lash. And Mr. Sell, I appreciate you saying that, but I look at this and it says trial court's proposed cut is $7 million and Supreme Court is $1.781 million. Supreme Court operations being 1.2 and civil and family legal services being 516. I guess I do have more questions about it. Maybe we don't have time in committee to go through this, but I would kind of like to know, because the loudest screaming to me is going to come from what are you doing on the ground, what are they doing up in the Supreme Court or central administration to take care of it. That's all. And like I said, we may not have time to address it now, but I am going to want to know that.
Mr. Saw, do you want to respond or
not? Mr. Chair and Representative West, obviously there's a much bigger, there's a huge difference in the total budget. The trial courts are a vast majority of our budget, $250 million or approximately. The Supreme Court is much smaller. So there's a proportionate cut in there that's being proposed. But I would be glad to speak with you separately about these issues.
That's fine, Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as a preface, you know, I strongly support the work of this committee. As I said up on the House floor during the bonding bill debate, you know, public safety should be one of the core functions of state government, and I meant that seriously. Although I will tell you, Mr. Chair, I quickly got an email from one of my constituents who said, no, you have it wrong, Representative Biskin. It should be the only thing they do, and keep your hands out of our pockets for anything else, but that's the sidelight. With that as a preface, all right, Mr. Fell, you mentioned the cuts that have to occur in people, mentioned the cuts that have to occur in programs, you mentioned the delays that would have to be experienced by our citizens, residents, etc. The one thing you didn't mention, though, and I want to know if this is on the table or not, is in the private sector, when there's a downturn, sometimes employees, to save positions, come back and rediscuss salaries and benefits. Ms. Bassell, is that on the table or is that completely off the table?
Ms. Bassell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, what we have done so far in those areas where layoffs are going to be needed now, there have been discussions with the union representatives. Employees have been, as I think we indicated earlier, have already agreed to voluntary leave without pay of some significant amount, and that's what we've done so far.
So, Mr. Chair, then Mr. Fell, if I heard you correctly, just to clarify, that is something that is also on the table, is that both sides are willing to at least discuss that concept.
Mr. Fell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskin, there will be discussions with our union representatives because of the magnitude of the cuts in employees, and I just, other than that, I can't say what those are going to deal with, other than to, I think there's a mutual concern about what this is going to do to both employees and to the system.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and I think that was answered quite appropriately.
Thanks. So have all the 10 deadships that we created last year been filled?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they have. They were effective January 1, so the process got underway in August, and so they are now filled.
Okay, would you have some other testifiers?
I'm sorry, Mr.
Do you have other people to testify?
Yes, I do. I'd like to now give you kind of a perspective of what these cuts are going to mean on the ground from Judge Lucy Whelan, the Chief Judge of the 4th District, Gary Scherer from the 10th District, and also with him is, if you come forward. Don't you come forward. And Judge Doug Mantua.
Welcome to the committee, Judge. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Lucy Whelan, and I'm the Chief Judge in the 4th District, which is Hennepin County. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I was asked to share with you two things. First, the cost-cutting measures that we've instituted to date, and secondly, what we would have to do should the governor's recommendations be put into effect. The 4th District, Hennepin County, ended up with, for 08, about a $1.2 million deficit based primarily to uncovered employee costs, but then secondly to some one-time costs for implementing our Mensis system in the criminal division. To make up this deficit, we cut about $600,000 out of our operational or non-salary budget. We did that by eliminating a supervised visitation program in family court, by eliminating our civil arbitration program, by eliminating all travel and education, all law book purchases, all court reporter per diems, and we reduced our conciliation court calendars by a third. The remaining $600,000 had to come from personnel, and so in November we instituted a hiring freeze. We currently have approximately 45 vacant positions in Hennepin County. And because of this significant vacancy rate, we've had to curtail services. And what we have done is we've closed our counters and telephone services on Wednesday afternoons. We have now, as I indicated, cut our conciliation court calendars by a third, which now means it takes about 6 to 8 weeks to schedule a hearing in conciliation court. We no longer conduct criminal record checks for the public, and we have are experiencing significant delays in our filing of cases, case updating, and response time to customer calls and questions. You saw the article, I think, that's in your packet. It takes us now 6 weeks to process a default judgment in Hennepin County because of staff shortages. So this is where we're at as of right now, and this is going to have to continue into 2009 to get a balanced budget at the end of the biennium. The governor's recommendation, the impact of that on the 4th District specifically, would require us to come up with an additional $1.8 million in cuts. To accomplish that, it's going to be virtually impossible for us to do and maintain current operations. What we have on the table right now are three things. The first would be to close two of our suburban courthouses, Ridgedale and Southdale, and move those cases to the government center into Brookdale. But I really want to point out here that these are not low-volume courthouses. Ridgedale and Southdale each handle over 30,000 cases a year. Those two suburban courts serve a total of 29 municipalities. And that is a lot of city attorneys, and it's a lot of police officers, and it's a lot of citizens moving either downtown or to Brookdale. They also don't have the space in Brookdale or downtown to handle all of those cases. So what we would probably have to do would be prioritize the cases and slow down, significantly slow down traffic, parking. The problem with that is that in 2007, Hennepin County, in criminal disbursements alone, received $37 million. And that, of course, ends up going to the city in general revenue, but it's the cities who will be primarily upset if that revenue stream gets cut back. The other thing we were looking at is our pro se service center, significantly reducing it, if not closing it. I think, as Ms. Sosel indicated, we saw 33,000 people in 2007 in our self-help center, primarily coming in on family court matters, housing court matters, probate adoption, expungements. We also have bilingual employees, both Somali and Spanish-speaking, in our self-help center, which cuts down on our interpreter costs because they're able to assist those individuals, and we would lose that benefit as well. Finally, we're looking, we currently staff five physicians in the Domestic Abuse Service Center, and we share that responsibility with the county, and we're looking at eliminating those positions. If we did all of those things, shut down the self-help center, close two suburban courts, and stop paying for the staff in the Domestic Abuse Service Center, that gets us to not quite $1.8 million. And that's maintaining the vacancy rate we currently have of about 45 positions. So this is would be a very devastating impact to our court and to the citizens of Hennepin County if we were forced to make these kind of reductions. Thank you very much. I don't know if you want to do questions now or just hear from the others.
Yeah, let's hear from all three. Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Scher. I'm the current chief judge of the 10th Judicial District. We're the second largest judicial district in the state of Minnesota. We have 45 judges in 8 different counties. For fiscal year 08, as a result of the funding, we were $1.2 million short in our district. For the 09 fiscal year, we were $1.8 million short, is our anticipation. If the governor's cut goes in, that would be an additional $1 million cut for a total of $4 million in this biennium. Currently, we have 17 vacancies in court administration. We have 4.5 vacancies for law clerks. We look and anticipate to have 4 early separation incentives being accepted. We've transferred employees between different counties to even up the differences in the counties. One of the best things I think that shows the commitment of our employees is that our employees have volunteered to take time without pay of $100,000 for this biennium. The only way we are able to meet our reductions is with permanent reductions in staffing, however. It is anticipated that we are going to lay off up to 10 people in the 10th district. Even though we have all these vacancies, it would be in addition to those vacancies. If the governor's cut occurs, we would have an additional 20-plus layoffs in addition to that. That would end up with more than a 17% reduction in our staffing within the 10th district. On July 1st of this year, we are closing the Cottage Grove Courthouse that's in Washington County. That courthouse has been open for, 25-plus years. We're no longer able to keep that facility open, and so we're going to be closing that, which will impact the cities of Woodbury, Cottage Grove, Newport, St. Paul Park. We are closing our counters, similar to what Hennepin County has done in some of our counties in our district. We're also cutting back our hours in some other counties. We're doing so many things to try to save money. We're not giving pro se litigants copies of forms they need anymore. We direct them now to the internet or to the law library, where they'll have to pay to make their own copies of these forms. We've slashed law book purchases. We've eliminated courtesy phones in our conference rooms and in the public areas of our courts. We have no contracts for equipment, training. Our employees are even making sure that they do not throw away paper clips. It's this deep. Most of our employees purchase their own pens. We're also cutting our collections people who assist us and do a good job in collecting money. We're also looking at no longer accepting credit card payments for payments of fines. The cost of the credit card fees to our district is $75,000, and we don't believe that we can continue to pay credit card fees and lay off people instead. And so we may stop accepting credit card payments, which will dramatically reduce the collections we bring in. The 10th Judicial District was one of the last two districts to come into state funding. Since we've been in state funding, we've anticipated that there were going to be reductions. We've had what we called an efficiency subcommittee within the 10th District that started meeting 2 years ago in anticipation of these things so that we could look at being efficient. But those efficiencies are not enough to stop the layoffs, and we simply no longer can do more with less.
Thank you, Judge, for your testimony. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Most of you I already know, but for those of you who don't, I'm Doug Meslow. I'm a judge in Anoka County in the 10th Judicial District. I'm not armed with statistics. I'm not a chief judge. I haven't been a judge very long. We all know why I'm here. It's because I sat where you're sitting. And now I've moved into the world of the courts. And so I can give you a perspective maybe that's a little bit different. I want to give you just a quick snapshot of what my week is this week, because I think it gives you a sense of what we do in the court. Monday I was assigned to probate calendar. That meant that I was handling estates of people who had passed away. I was doing conservatorships and guardianships for people who could no longer take care of themselves. I squeezed in a family court hearing as well as a hearing where there was a request for an order for protection. Yesterday they were shorthanded in Washington County, so I was loaned over to Stillwater, where I heard a calendar of misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, and felonies. Today is my light day, which means I had time to come here. Late morning and early afternoon, I'll hear probation violations and take some sentencing that I set on. I kept this as a light day because tomorrow I've got juvenile court and children who are in need of protection. I've got 24 cases. I'll be studying those this afternoon, because the evaluations that I'll be making are what kinds of services do we need to provide to families so that they're able to, so that the children are in a safe, healthy environment, and when is it time to say these families aren't capable of doing that anymore, the children need to be removed and need to be put someplace else permanently. So those are the difficult decisions that come in tomorrow. Friday, then I'll be handling juvenile court again, but this time it will be criminal cases, juvenile charged with violating different crimes. So those are the kinds of things that I'll be doing through the week. Those are the kinds of things that the court system deals with on a daily basis. Last year about this time, I came to the committee, didn't speak at this table, but did have conversations with some of you. You'll remember I didn't ask for a nickel for judges. And that's not because I think judges are overpaid. It's because I was looking at priorities. And to me, the priorities are the way we serve the public, and that means the staff that we have at the courts are the lifeblood of what we do. These are the people who create the calendars and figure out exactly who gets into court on what day. These are the people who put in the information after court, reflecting the criminal record, reflecting the various orders that may provide protection, may provide opportunities for people to recover money and address those issues down the line. These are the people who deal with the public face-to-face on a daily basis. And when we talk about the kinds of cuts that are coming in, that's what we're losing. That's what's not going to be happening on the level that we're used to. It's a nice thing to be able to say that we're going to do more with less. But the truth is, we'll do less with less. And that's what it comes to. A few minutes ago, Representative Biskins repeated a mantra that I heard on at least a weekly basis in this committee. Public safety is a core function of government. And it is. And when we're talking about these cuts, we're talking about cutting into the core. That's going to mean reduced access. That's going to mean delayed justice. And as we've also heard many times, justice delayed can very often be justice denied. That's not what I'm about. And I know that's not what the committee is about. And that's why I urge you to take a good look at what can be done to preserve the justice that we have in Minnesota, justice of which we can be very proud. I'll tell you that my job is incredibly exciting, incredibly demanding, and incredibly rewarding. And I would welcome the chance to have any of you, when this session is over, to come and sit with me and watch it happen. I would enjoy that greatly. If you have any questions either today or in the future, I'm going to give you my direct dial number. It's 763-323-6010. And I'm happy to help in any way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. You know, Judge Winslow, I could always count on you to respond honestly to a question. So I will ask you, the governor has recommended $50 million for cuts to this committee, and you know the agencies and divisions that are under the auspices of this committee. So give us some ideas of where we should make those cuts if the $15 million holds up target. The Department of Corrections, BCA, Public Safety, Crime Victims, Human Rights, do you have any ideas for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and what I would indicate is, first of all, as I remember when I was here, there aren't any printing presses where we're printing out money here in some basement room in the Capitol, are there? There weren't the last I checked. Yeah, that would be an interesting idea anyway. But you're absolutely right, Mr. Chair. Every dollar that goes into the court system has to come from someplace else, whether it's another place that's under the committee's jurisdiction or it's another place within the budget. Here's the budget I don't feel qualified to answer. I have not studied the rest of your budget, Mr. Chair. I'm not clear on what's gone in to each of those areas, each of those fields. So I can't tell you, well, the correction system got X million dollars, they should get X million dollars minus four, because I haven't studied those numbers. The question you ask is, I understand exactly the question the committee has to answer. And the only reason I'm ducking it is I'm not qualified to answer it. If you wanted to invite me to look at all of those numbers and figure all that out and make a recommendation, I would do that. But I also understand that's beyond That's beyond my authority.
I fully expected you to have a response like that. I just want the courts to understand the dilemma we're facing, and this is not something we want, and we have to grapple with this over the next week or so and try to figure out our recommendations, because not all of us agree with the governor's recommendations, but we're still have to figure out where the money is going to come from. But I appreciate your testimony, and
thank you, Mr. Chair. And with deepest respect, if I were sitting in any of the chairs around that table, that is precisely the question I would be asking myself right now. That is the right question, as you well know. I'm just not qualified to answer it.
That's no less.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question is for Judge Weiland. I was given a list of, from November 28th, recent surplus or deficit amounts from various judicial districts, and I see in the 4th District reported, and this may not be accurate, but reported a $900,000 deficit. Do you know if that's accurate, Mr. Chair? Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair and Judge Weiland. I also note that over in Hennepin, you filled 28 to 30 employee positions in the last 6 months as well. Is that true?
No.
That's why I want to go through the chair, please, if we're taping this.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we instituted our hiring freeze in November, and so we've hired nobody since then.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Wallen, but prior to November, did you fill those 28 to 30 positions?
Mr. Chair and Representative West, I don't have that information in terms of how many people we hired in the summer and fall.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking is because, depending on if these numbers are correct, there are different judicial districts that reported substantial surpluses, and some of them had deficits, and I'm not certain, and I know some of this is related to the staffing study or weighted caseload study, which some people have problems with, weighted caseload being how many of you guys should be dealing with this, but then also it has been extrapolated to how much funding you should get, which is what I want to explore more, and which what I think Ms. DeSalle said she would get back to me on in terms of funding numbers. But my second question, if I may, Mr. Chair, for the three judges up here are, do you think that we could resolve some of these problems and maybe get to more cases if you guys had 4 weeks of vacation instead of 6 every year? Did they get 12?
I don't think you get 12.
Okay, well, I understand that, Mr. Chair. The reason I'm asking this, and I know it's not a popular question to ask, is I run into problems a lot of times where we have judges that are gone, and you're all doing some different thing at some different time. But I wonder, and it may be judicial education or maybe outright vacation, but I wonder if maybe some of that were pared back on for the time being. We may get some cost savings somewhere in the budget. Would you consider exploring that at all?
Chair, members of the committee, if you heard my presentation about cuts, the cuts went to judges, the cuts were to staff. Whether we have more judges, that just means that the fewer staff that we're all going to have will take longer to implement all the work that the judges are doing. So it's not just the top judges that you have to look at, it's all the staff that needs to run the entire system, and we're hurting there. That will affect us regardless of whether we have more judge time or not.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Judge Scherr, but with all respect, I disagree. You guys are the captains of the ship in your courtroom, and when we have a case that's set to go to trial, and you're not there, you're not available, or, for example, you're dealing with a pending felony and my gross misdemeanor gets bumped, there's no judge to deal with it, so it continues on, and then staff time has to be used to deal with it at that point. So I think, obviously, you know, back in the day, when there was a single judge in the courthouse out on the prairie, there wasn't staff to deal with it. They just levied their decision right there. case disposed of. So that's why I'm asking the question.
If I might, Mr. Chair. Old habits die hard. Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I can only talk about my personal experience and then how I project that out. It's a dramatic change that there's this vacation time. I came out of the private sector where it was an unusual year. If I took 3 weeks of vacation, I'm not using all my vacation time. I had a felony jury trial calendar last Monday with 31 cases, and I didn't consider the week done until all 31 of those cases were done, and not a single one was continued out of that calendar. And so those things can be done and should be done. My concern is that we are going to have a problem with the cuts, where literally we don't have staff inside the courtroom. We're going to actually have situations where we've got judges not able to go into courtrooms because we don't have staff to be able to handle the calendars with us. That is crazy, because that makes no sense at all. Then we're not being used to our full capacity. My feeling is I ought to be used to my full capacity. I've got two cases under advisement. One of them is 3 weeks old, one of them is 1 week old. You stay on top of things. That's the way things need to be done. But we have to have staff there with us in the courtroom. That's what we're going to lose. That's our problem.
Representative Lesh, I have a couple more people who want to ask questions.
Thank you. Then, Mr. Chair, I'll just make a closing comment. I think this is one of these problems where, you know, we tie our hands. There are certain cases where, yeah, if you don't have an interpreter and there's a case that obviously needs an interpreter, you know, it's appellate fodder if in fact you don't deal with that way. But there are other cases where that's not necessarily the case, and you can deal with it. I know in Ramsey County we have a big calendar, and there's a court staff individual sitting right there entering data into TSIS at the time, which can be different when we change over. But I just think that we need to get creative about this as we move forward. And as judges, you're in a unique position to do that, because oftentimes there's a tendency to say, well, you know, I can't do it. Sorry, this is the way the system runs. And as of right now, I know that the three of you aren't part of the problem with that. You're here testifying at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday morning, but so you're not going to be the ones that are going to be the dead end on that. But there are some judges that are, which is why I wanted to ask the question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all my comments.
We have one more person who wants to testify. Are these questions directed to the judges, Representative Lily Murphy Zellers? Or can we hear from the...
Mr. Chair, my question is more general, related to an inquiry with regards to the proposals by the governor. And I, you know, just during this process, I just get more and more frustrated, and just hearing these cuts and then hearing the folks buying pens and the cases and all this stuff. Are we going to hear from the governor's staff? You know, I don't want to do what we went through yesterday as far as, you know, their thought process or a little sheet of paper or whatever. But, I mean, can we get the governor's staff up here or somebody to say why they're proposing this and why they feel that public safety isn't maybe important for Minnesota, and, you know, that I think our committee does bipartisanly agree that it's very important. But, you know, I'm just getting kind of tired of hearing some of these, and are we going to hear? I guess it's my question to you as a chairman, I guess.
I hadn't planned on scheduling someone, but we can call the governor's office and see if they'd like to come over.
Because, you know, I mean, we've had, I think, convincing testimony again today, and, you know, yesterday, I thought, again, we did, and, you know, it's just, you know, all these lists, I'd just like to hear why they don't, for example, like suburban courts, I'd just like to hear why they don't think they're of use or helpful, or, you know, the domestic violence, you know, why we need our staff buying pens, why we need Judge Methlow doing 24 cases, you know, for kids. I mean, are they really getting fair attention? So anyways, I'm just kind of getting a little tired.
We have a, Representative Lily, as you know, almost $1 billion deficit, and doesn't seem to be a move to raise any revenue. Therefore, cuts have to be made unless you can figure out something else. And I'm happy to have someone from the governor's office come over and testify as to how they prioritize that. But And remember, this is a recommendation from the governor. We can make our own recommendations, and I would encourage the court to talk to the governor's office and also explain the impact of these cuts on the governor's office. Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I just can't even, you know, from spending time with the folks on this committee, I really can't see this even getting a single vote, so I'm just really curious, you know, of how this proceeds, but, you know.
Thank you. Absolutely. Representative Murphy, did you have a question of the judges, or is it a general? Because we have Mr. Melendez that I wanted to have.
I have a question of Judge Meslow in the 24 people that you're going to see tomorrow, or the 24 cases, are they going to be disposed of tomorrow?
Judge Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, probably not, because what happens in the CHIPS cases is that it is an ongoing process. Oftentimes what's happening is that it's an ongoing update. What's happening, there may be some sort of counseling or treatment related to the drug issues that are going on. There may be some other programs that are happening. So part of that is a check-in. Part of that then relates to what the progress updates are. Typically, a CHIPS file, once opened, needs to be closed within a year. And in that time, I see the same file the whole time. We don't pass them off to multiple judges so that I stay current on them. I will probably see that case every 2 to 3 months in that process.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for Judge Wyland. And this is a discussion we have quite often about our regional disbursements of assets. Usually it's related to transportation, where the people are, where the roads are. My question, and if you don't have the facts, that's quite all right, but what is the increase in caseload, and what is the proportion of the caseload in Hennepin County, say, to any other counties or any other districts around the state? And what I'm getting to is, if you're seeing the cases, you should be having the funds. No offense to some of our greater Minnesota or outstate Minnesota, whichever you prefer, but if the vast majority of the cases, the vast majority of the cars are driving in the metropolitan area, maybe that's the vast majority of the funds should be going.
That's Rylan.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I believe that Hennepin County handles over 25% of the cases generally in the state. The issue we have as a judiciary is that we have an obligation to provide access to justice all over the state, in big counties and in small counties. And having now been state-funded for really the whole system for only 2 years, we're now struggling with what you're implying, which is that how much money does the judiciary need to fund access to justice in the smaller counties in the more remote parts of the state, and yet still adequately fund the large urban courts who are, you know, where we see more people. And I think you probably got my earlier point about each of our suburban courts, of course, are much larger than many of the courthouses in smaller counties. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the courthouses in smaller counties shouldn't be there. But, you know, these are the kind of tough decisions we have to make about where we put our money.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're very judicious, no pun intended, with your your assessment, Judge. I would say a little bit, and I'm growing up on a farm, and my grandmother taught in a one-room schoolhouse, but I don't think we're going to go back to that. So the one-room courthouse or the county courthouse is one judge. I appreciate it, but I don't think we're going to step that far back. Mr. Chairman and members, I think that's a discussion we have around here quite often. Where's the bulk of the case? Where's the bulk of the traffic? Where are the bulk of the people? Where are the bulk of the funds going to go? With that, majority of the funds, then you also have a bigger target to shave off some of those funds. But I think that needs to be part of the mix, Mr. Chairman. And 30,000 cases in two suburban courtrooms, I think that speaks volumes to where we maybe should reprioritize. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, judges. And thank you, Judge Mitchell, for stopping by. And we did have one question. Do you work harder there or when you were here?
Judge Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zeller, of course, thank you. And it's good to be back. And secondly, the nice thing is I have one job now instead of two. It was always a little tough trying to manage the law practice and the legislature at the same time. It's nice working one job instead of two.
Thank you, judges, for your testimony. We want to hear now from Brian Melendez. And if there's anybody else who wants to testify about the court budget, we will take some brief testimony. We're running out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand that that the hour is growing late, even though it's still early in the morning, and I believe that I can abbreviate my comments. My name is Brian Melendez. I'm here as the president of the Minnesota State Bar Association. I'm not speaking for any other organization that I am affiliated with. The Bar Association very much appreciates the dilemma of scarce resources that the legislature is facing, and obviously we don't have the answers to all the questions. But I do think it's important for the committee to hear the view of the practicing bar. You've heard a lot of testimony, you've heard a lot of facts and figures. I don't have hard data for you. I'm here really to speak on behalf of the experience of the practicing bar, most of which comes to me anecdotally. And since you have already heard so much information, I believe that I can abbreviate my testimony to three short points. Number one, the Bar Association fully supports the point of view of the judicial branch and the factual information that they are bringing to you. It's very consistent with the experience of practicing lawyers about increasing delays, scarcity of resources, and declining services in the justice system. Everything that they say, we agree with. Second, the chair asked the question of one of the earlier witnesses about, how come the actual results that we are getting are so far off from the forecasts that were made 18 months ago? I can shed a little bit of light on that, and I think this is a point that was not made earlier. During bad economic times, the workload of the courts increases. Because during bad economic times, you have generally more domestic violence, more child support issues, more employment issues, more mortgage foreclosures, more debt collection, and in some cases more low-level criminal cases that the court system sees. So as the economy grows worse, the strain on the system grows greater. And as we all know, the economy has taken a significant downturn just in the past few months in a way that I don't think was foreseen by anybody a year or a year and a half ago when the forecasts were made. And finally, I want to follow up on a point that Representative Lesch made. In one of his examples, he talked about, why am I faced with the situation of one of my gross misdemeanor cases getting bumped for a felony case? Well, the fact is that if the courts are limited in the amount of cases that they can process, then they have to prioritize. And I want to highlight a slightly different issue than the distinction between criminal priorities that Representative Lesch made, and that is the distinction between the civil and the criminal caseload of the courts. There is a constitutional right to, depending on which constitution you look at, a speedy criminal trial or, under the state constitution, a criminal trial promptly and without delay. What that means is that as a matter of constitutional law, the courts have to process criminal cases more quickly than they process civil ones. And if there is a lot of strain on the system, the strain often has to be absorbed by the civil caseload. Well, we've seen the experience in other states about what happens when the courts are forced to spend most of their energy on criminal cases. Civil cases don't get hurt. There have been situations in states as disparate as California and New Hampshire where civil backlogs resulted in the courts virtually not hearing civil cases at all for months and in one case years at a time, which had a significant effect on the economy, the commercial practices in the state. Businesses don't want to go to a state where they can't get disputes resolved. We may be headed down that road if we have those same kind of cuts in Minnesota. And Mr. Chair, I believe most of the other points that I intended to make were made by earlier witnesses, and out of respect for the committee's time, I will conclude there. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Melendez, for your testimony and questions. Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify about the courts? Mr. Sal, can you come up for one last question before we adjourn? Oh, and before we begin, I need a motion to approve the March 11th minutes. Representative Zellers moved the minutes of March 11th. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Saul, if you knew that you were facing this deficit, and you obviously did, a long time ago, because I was under the impression that we adequately funded you last year. And then we hear $15 million deficit, $20 million deficit. I'm not quite sure where it actually is. Nevertheless, why did you proceed to fill and allow the governor to fill the 10 judgeships that we created if you knew you were going to have this kind of predicament?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that we, at that time, when we started in August, didn't appreciate it because the settlements don't come in until then. So I think that that's part of the problem, is that we certainly didn't have an understanding that the 2.5%, which is what we projected, and we projected a cost that was substantially higher, even just with that 2.5% than the appropriation ended up to be. But then going from 2.5 to 3.25 was really something that we had not expected. And it was, and those negotiations, I think, were not complete until sometime in August. Some of them were even later than that, I think even as late as November. So I think that we're not in that early time frame when we start this process, understanding the magnitude of what the impact was going to be.
Very good. Thank you. Is there any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. This meeting's adjourned.